It's Friday, April 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, airstrikes continue in Aleppo, Syria. We talk with a representative from Doctors Without Borders about the deadly attack this week on a hospital.
This was a major kind of referral center for complex pediatric cases, for complex cases involving children. Of the 34 beds in the hospital, 8 were dedicated to pediatrics.
The U.S. disciplined 16 military personnel over a hospital bombing last year in Afghanistan. And we look at the year after the riots that erupted in Baltimore, Maryland, following the death of a man in police custody. It's all ahead. Civil defense officials in Syria say airstrikes continued Friday in Aleppo, where a clinic was hit one day after a strike destroyed a hospital. The clinic, which had been providing treatment for chronic illness and dental services for about 5 years, was badly damaged. A nurse was among several people wounded. Earlier this week, an airstrike destroyed a hospital in Aleppo, which was supported by Doctors Without Borders. Among the dead was a man believed to be the last pediatrician working in rebel-controlled areas of the city. Samuel Taylor is a spokesman for Doctors Without Borders. Speaking from Amman, Jordan, he tells me about the destruction of the hospital.
This is an absolute tragedy for the people of Aleppo. As you mentioned, one of the last pediatricians, we're not sure if he was the total last, but there's only 70 or 80 doctors left in Aleppo, which is a city that has 250,000 people. So this was a major kind of referral center for complex pediatric cases, for complex cases involving children. Of the 34 beds in the hospital, 8 were dedicated to pediatrics. So obviously this is a huge loss.
The idea that the hospital in Aleppo was directly targeted, it must be, you know, highly disturbing to your organization.
This is a trend that we've seen for some time now. I mean, Doctors Without Borders, we did a survey last year that we wrote a report on the basis of this survey, where we talked to around 70 medical structures in besieged areas in particular, and we documented more than 90 attacks on medical structures in the last in 2015. This year alone, in 2016, on just Doctors Without Borders supported structures, we've had 11 attacks. So this is an extremely worrying trend. But, you know, the thing to realize is, we talk about hospitals because we're a medical organization, but bakeries are being bombed, marketplaces are being bombed, schools are being bombed. There does seem to be a consistent pattern of targeting what makes life livable for people.
Now, I believe that the attacks, there is a continuing fighting going on in Aleppo?
That's correct. I mean, we hear on a daily basis, including today, of new attacks on schools, on hospitals, on all kinds of targets. There's massive amounts of violence occurring at the moment in Aleppo. There was a slight reduction in violence with the cessation of a violence agreement that was made in February, but that seems to be out of the window now. The levels of violence are off the scale. There is one way in and one way out of Aleppo, to the west of the city, and we're very concerned that if this offensive continues by the government of Syria and its allies, and if that road is closed, then Aleppo will become besieged. Now, as I said, there are 250,000 people in Aleppo. Doctors Without Borders, we estimate there are at least 1.5 million people living in siege conditions inside Syria. And the last thing we want to see is more people in those conditions.
The humanitarian situation must be very dire.
Doctors Without Borders has been working in war zones, in natural disasters, all over the world for more than 40 years. This is the most complex context we've ever worked in. We can't work in Islamic State group-controlled areas because they abducted some of our staff and failed to meet assurances that they'd given us. We don't work in the government of Syria-controlled areas because we've been unable to negotiate access. But, you know, the needs are absolutely off the scale, and access is a huge problem, not just for Doctors Without Borders, but for all international NGOs.
Is there any kind of medical facility or any remaining medical personnel? Are they just operating out of regular buildings now?
No, I mean, as far as we know, as I said, the 95% of the medical staff have left Aleppo, which we totally understand. Doctors Without Borders, we're not physically present. We have 6 facilities inside Syria, but in the north, west and the northeast, in non-government held areas. There are massive shortages of medical staff, but we fully understand why people flee. You know, these are unbearable conditions. And there are, as I say, around 70 or 80 doctors still left inside Aleppo, but for 250,000 people, that's an extremely small amount of people.
And so any people that are further injured in Aleppo, there just must be minimal ability to treat them medically.
To be honest, I mean, they do amazing work, these Syrian teams inside. We've been supplying 23 medical structures. That includes health posts, field hospitals, and full hospitals, but for several years now. And the work they do is astonishing. It's absolutely astonishing. They're at a very high level. And, you know, it's unbelievable that they've stayed through these horrible levels of violence. But, yeah, frankly, I mean, they must be under intense pressure at this stage because they're seeing daily bombings and shootings, and the injuries, the trauma injuries that we hear about are extreme. But, I mean, I'm sure they're doing the very best they can, but the demands on them are huge.
That's Samuel Taylor. He's a spokesman for Doctors Without Borders. Well, joining me here in the studio is Hannah Klarner. So, Hannah, what's happening?
We've got a lot happening today, especially online on Twitter. It's International Dance Day, and so we're seeing a lot of involvement with celebrities, particularly musicians, dancers, people like Ariana Grande sharing their favorite dance routines from some of their past tours, some of their current tours. And Lego has joined in as one of the brands that's been tweeting, and they sent out a little GIF of a little yellow Lego man dancing. But they're also trending for more than one reason today. Their vice president actually came out and admitted that the company made a mistake when they refused to fulfill Ai Weiwei's order back in September. So the politically active artist was going to do an installation piece, and it was denied by Lego because they don't approve of people using their products for political reasons. And just recently, their vice president actually admitted that this was a mistake on the part of the company.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting that they said that. What else is trending?
We also have today's Arbor Day. So it's a day to celebrate trees, especially lovely spring trees that are starting to get all their leaves back. So that actually just started trending very recently, a few hours ago. And it's gaining a lot of traction with environmental groups and environmentally conscious celebrities. So Erin Brockovich, you may remember the movie named after her and her environmental presence there. She tweeted, "I think I shall never see a smokestack lovely as a tree. Happy Arbor Day. Nothing wrong with hugging a tree." So she's just one of the celebrities who's joining that bandwagon. And another popular quotation we're seeing people share is a Chinese proverb: "The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, and the next best time is now."
Oh. Very, very, very nice. Well, thanks, Hannah. Mm-hmm. That is Hannah Klarner reporting for us on social media. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Out in the far reaches of our solar system lies the Kuiper Belt. This region of space is occupied by icy objects left over from the creation of the solar system. Several dwarf planets, such as Pluto, also occupy the Kuiper Belt. Astronomers studying images gathered by the Hubble Space Telescope in 2015 say that they have found a dark and tiny moon circling the dwarf planet of Makemake, the smaller sister of Pluto. Makemake, discovered in 2005, was named after a deity worshipped by the Rapa Nui people of Easter Island. This newfound moon, the first companion to the dwarf planet that's ever been seen, has been nicknamed MK2. Its diameter is estimated to be about 260 kilometers across and was found orbiting Makemake at a distance of about 21,000 kilometers. Astronomers will further study MK2 to determine whether its orbit is elliptical or circular. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a look at last year's Baltimore riots. The Pentagon has disciplined 16 military personnel, including a two-star general, for their role in last year's mistaken airstrike on a hospital in Afghanistan that killed 42 people. I'm joined now by VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, what have authorities said about this attack and the reasons that it happened?
Well, General Joseph Votel, who is the new commander of U.S. Central Command, announced some of the findings today, and he was stressing that this was an extraordinarily intense situation. It basically started after days of fighting. The U.S. forces in Kunduz had been with their Afghan counterparts for several days. They were running out of supplies. They were panicking a little bit, and this caused a launch of this AC-130 gunship about 69 minutes earlier than it was planned. That was crucial because it missed important information, including the no-strike list that they always receive before they go out to target any specific area throughout all of Afghanistan. And so they missed that. But that's not the end-all be-all because, of course, there are different ways to get that information to this gunship. However, the antenna that was supposed to give this information to the gunship failed. So they weren't able to get that information. And on top of that, they weren't able to send the pictures of their intended target to the ground so the ground could confirm, yes, this is the target. After that, then another extraordinary thing happened. They had an attack from a surface-to-air missile, which General Votel said, understand this. This is incredibly extraordinary in Afghanistan. This does not happen very often. And so the gunship had to then go several kilometers away from the target, which affected the accuracy of the targeting system. And so when they plugged in the coordinates that they were given, instead of seeing the Taliban building, they saw this open field. And what the crew did is they tried to figure out which building is this Taliban building when their targeting system is telling them that they should be targeting an open field, which is clearly wrong. The nearest building that fit the visual description that they had been given of the target was this MSF, Doctors Without Borders Hospital. And so they mistakenly concluded that this has to be that Taliban building. They started targeting it. MSF notified the military about this about 10 minutes into this barrage, which, as you mentioned, killed 42 people. But it took several minutes to get through the chain of command to the commander on the ground, who then said, hey, stop firing. This is a hospital. But, of course, you know that it was too late at that point. So many people had been killed.
Well, and now what kind of discipline is involved here?
Well, this discipline includes letters of reprimand. One of those 16 people that is going to be or that has been disciplined is a two-star general. So this is not something just a light tap on the wrist. This is even though you can see that there were several errors that happened and it wasn't intentionally ever determined that no U.S. service member ever wanted to hit a hospital. Even though that was determined, there were still so many errors that these 16 members were reprimanded. This is not just, like I said, not just a tap on the wrist. This could prevent these people from being promoted. It could even possibly kick some of them out of the service. So this is a very serious event.
Are there any recommendations for the future to ensure a similar attack does not happen again?
Yes, they have already made changes. Under General John Campbell, the former head of ISAF forces in Afghanistan, he delivered training to all 9,000 personnel in Afghanistan. That was given to them to help relearn everything that needs to go on when there's a target. And then in addition to that, all of these gunships are now preloaded with the information of the no-strike list, something that would have been so critical if they had just known ahead of time that MSF building was on the no-strike list. So now instead of having this potential for error due to leaving earlier, due to having a satellite antenna failure, now all of these gunships will have that before they leave.
Thanks very much, Carla. That's VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Now it's time for financial news, and I'm joined by Jill Malandrino, who joins us from New York City. Hello, Jill.
Hey, Sarah.
Okay, well, what's the market doing today?
Well, you know what? We are looking to close a very busy week of earnings and news highlighted by six M&A transactions on Thursday, the Federal Reserve and Bank of Japan this week. We saw weak GDP numbers and disappointing quarterly results from some of our top tech companies like Apple, for example. So we were looking to close April with a gain, but it looks as if the S&P 500 and Dow Jones Industrial Average will actually be red for the month if trading continues the way that it is right now through the close. And the NASDAQ, because of the weakness we're seeing in tech stocks and biotech stocks, is actually down for seven consecutive sessions. So there's a little bit of a shift in momentum here. I think investors were disappointed that after the Federal Reserve delivered their communique, yes, they didn't take up interest rates, but they sounded more hawkish, meaning that there could be more tightening in monetary policy. The Bank of Japan, they didn't add more stimulus. That impacted the market as well. Poor earnings reports from bellwethers like an Apple's another thing that's weighing on the markets. But at the end of the day, this type of corrective activity is not a bad thing. And investors shouldn't be pulling their money out of the market, and you shouldn't get so worried. A lot of investors have been looking for more attractive entry points because the market has been on such a wild run to the upside since February 11th. Some of this corrective activity could afford retail investors some good entry points in stocks that they feel have ran away from them.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Jill. That's okay. Jill Malandrino in New York. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Riots erupted in Baltimore, Maryland last year following the death of Freddie Gray in police custody. Six police officers faced charges relating to his death and are awaiting trial. I'm joined by VOA correspondent Chris Simpkins, who's looking at the impact the events have had on the city. Chris, what led to the violence that erupted a year ago?
Well, one of the causes was the death of a 25-year-old young man named Freddie Gray, who died from injuries suffered while in a police van. The death was sort of the catalyst or the spark that was thrown on the fire of many years of social and economic problems in Baltimore that have existed for 4 to 5 decades. Poverty, lack of education, high crime, high unemployment. These are factors that caused the uprising a year ago.
So, Chris, in the time since, what has gone into building better relations between the community in Baltimore and the city's police department?
Well, they've tried to engage the community in a number of programs, mostly aimed at young Baltimore residents. They've had some success with that. But, Sarah, there's a deep mistrust between the community and the police because of years of incidents involving mostly African-American men being killed by Baltimore police officers in unusual circumstances. So rebuilding that trust means getting out into the community and showing the community that they care, that they are trying to protect them. But on the other hand, since the uprising a year ago, crime in the Baltimore neighborhoods that were most affected by the riots has gone up. And the feeling among the people that I spoke with in the community is that the police have kind of laid back in patrolling these communities and not been as aggressive in policing as they were prior to the Freddie Gray incident. So I think they want to see more efforts being led by the police department that will address this spike in crime that they are seeing. And I think from talking to people in the community, the criminal element in Baltimore sees that the police have backed off, which has given them a little bit more space to commit crime. So people in the neighborhood definitely want the police to try to do things that will reduce crime in their community, but not harass and target and brutalize the people who live in the neighborhood.
So this is the West Baltimore?
This is West Baltimore. It's a section where it's a mostly African-American community neighborhood. And as you know, Baltimore is more than half African-American total population.
Mm-hmm. And it's been a poor city. I mean, it's had harder economic times than, say, Washington, D.C., which is nearby. But
yeah, it's just a short 40-minute drive away but you think you're in two different worlds. A lot more poverty in Baltimore than Washington, D.C. There's some 17,000 abandoned homes in the city, mostly because they were neglected by landlords who just left the city and left the property to decay. So that's a problem. So the city's not able to generate the kind of tax revenue if people were living in those homes. Secondly, a quarter of all Baltimore residents live in poverty. So that gives you an indication of the level of income in that city. Very high jobless numbers, because a lot of the major manufacturing companies like Bethlehem Steel left Baltimore, closed down their operations, and there were a number of manufacturers who were in Baltimore that shut their doors, and this has led to high unemployment, especially in the Black community in Baltimore.
Thanks very much, Chris. That's VOA correspondent Chris Simpkins. You can read his reports on the Baltimore violence and its aftermath on our website, voanews.com. That's our show. Please remember to visit our website at VOA News. And I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the release of the State Department's annual country reports on human rights, which document human rights conditions in 177 countries, including Iran, Assistant Secretary of State of the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labor, Tom Malinowski, noted that the reports come at a time when authoritarian governments are striking out with particular ferocity against the freedoms of expression, association, and the press. The report on Iran notes severe restrictions on civil liberties, including the freedoms of assembly, association, speech, including via the internet, religion, and press. It also cites limitations on citizens' ability to choose their government through free and fair elections, abuse of due process with escalating use of capital punishment for crimes that do not meet international minimum standards of most serious crimes, arbitrary detention, politically motivated violence and repression, harsh prison conditions, discrimination against women, ethnic and religious minorities, as well as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex persons. The human rights reports contain numerous examples of rights abuses from around the world. In Iran, they include the case of labor activist Shahrokh Zamani, who died in custody in Rajai Shahr prison, of the deteriorating medical condition of journalist and human rights activist Narges Mohammadi, who has been charged with propaganda against the state and assembly and collusion against national security, of the forced virginity test of imprisoned cartoonist and activist Atena Farag Dhani, originally sentenced to 12 years for such crimes as spreading propaganda and insulting members of parliament. In an interview with the Broadcasting Board of Governors, Assistant Secretary Malinowski noted that when President Hassan Rouhani was elected, the Iranian people had high expectations because of his promises to improve human rights and the rule of law. Unfortunately, we have not seen significant changes, said Mr. Malinowski.
One constant through this is that the Iranian people want to live in a more normal country. They have said that to their own government and to the international community every chance that they have had.
Assistant Secretary Malinowski noted that the nuclear agreement between the P5 plus one countries and Iran has raised hopes for greater normality in the future. But true normality is only going to come, he said, if the Iranian government rights its relationship with its own people through respect for law, respect for human rights, respect for those international norms which are important in Iran and everywhere in the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.